It's a pleasure now on Sunday night in this Science Week to welcome a distinguished visitor to Australia. He's a professor of nuclear science and engineering at MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and also a practicing Christian who does not shy away from the big questions. He's Professor Ian Hutchinson, recently the author of Monopolizing Knowledge, a book that leaps straight to the heart of the religion-science controversy. Ian Hutchinson, welcome to Sunday Night.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here.
It's what prompted you to, as a scientist and a practicing Christian, leap into the heart of what's a very fraught debate, and it tends to be the territory of bomb throwers on both sides.
Well, I think there is a sense in which the bomb throwers get most of the media coverage, but I don't think they necessarily have either the best arguments or the bulk of the thought about this question. My interests have been developed over many years when I've spent a great deal of time talking about the relationship between science and faith. And I've been speaking to university audiences predominantly, but also in many cases church and public audiences. And I've found that there is actually a tremendous interest in this debate, particularly among young people. One of the things about this discussion is that, especially in America, which is where I live these days, perhaps this is also true in Australia, there's actually a shying away from discussion of questions, the big questions of life within the universities. There's a sense in which the so-called separation of church and state is being implemented even within our academic world in such a way that people think it's somehow inappropriate to talk about God or about religious questions. And I am quite the opposite way inclined myself. And
yes,
I think
it's almost become the default position, hasn't it? The no God position, or the let's not talk about God position. It's almost the default courtesy position.
Well, it's certainly remarkable if people think that it's impolite to discuss the big questions of life, what the meaning of life is, where we're headed for, and whether there's a God. These seem to me historically to have been part of the main reasons for there being universities at all. And yet today, it seems very often it's considered to be just out of the bounds.
Well, let's talk about some of the issues you raise in your book, Monopolizing Knowledge. By that, you're implying that science has become the default position in terms of the whole field of knowledge itself. The word you use is a word that's been around for many years but has fallen out of use over the last 30 or 40 years, scientism.
Yeah, I think it's very important to distinguish between science and scientism. I'm a scientist. I believe very strongly that science is an important part of our human knowledge, perhaps in some respects the most important part of our knowledge, at least as far as our knowledge of the world of nature is concerned. But scientism refers to the idea that is very commonplace, although not often explicitly expressed, which is that somehow science is all the real knowledge there is, and that other forms of knowledge are either superstition or opinion or just plain nonsense. I strongly repudiate that view. I think there are lots of different ways in which humans build up their knowledge of the world. Science is a very important one.
And by science, you mean the scientific method?
Yes, exactly. Science is a tricky word because historically science just, you know, hundreds of years ago, long, long ago, science just meant any systematic form of knowledge. But nowadays, when we use the unqualified word science, what I mean, what most people mean, is the natural sciences, the science of the natural world, the ways in which we've built up our understanding of the way in which the world behaves reproducibly, the way in which it behaves in such a way we can describe it through measurements and other
testable hypotheses, falsifiability, all of that sort of stuff.
Well, falsifiability is an important issue in science. I think there are non-scientific questions that are perfectly falsifiable, so I don't think that's a good demarcation, but it's really the extent to which the world behaves reproducibly in a way that we can describe with great clarity, often mathematical clarity. That's what I mean by science, and I think that's what most people mean by science. And I think scientism is taking that attitude, taking the techniques and the methods that we have developed to find out that knowledge, and supposing that they are the only useful way of finding knowledge, and saying we're going to apply these to all other types of disciplines. And I think that it's simply a mistake to think in that way, even though that is, as you suggested, a kind of default position in the academy and in our society as a whole. And the purpose of my book is to say that this is a way of really just trying to monopolize knowledge, but pretend to a monopoly of knowledge, whereas in fact, we humans know things through many different approaches. We have, if you like, as an analogy, we have different senses. We have sight, we have hearing, we have taste, and so forth. And to suppose that the only way of getting to know about the world is through sight would be a mistake. Well, in the same way, broadly intellectually, we have many ways of understanding and gaining knowledge of our world, and science, natural science, is one of them, but it's not the only one.
This opens up a challenge to a whole series of fields of what are called knowledge, and it does become problematic, because when you talk about science, what do you do with areas such as political science? I mean, where are the boundaries? And that you can say, well, certain elements of this are testable. We can take surveys of populations and see what they think. But the actual writing, the digestion of the material, adds something more than simply the science of measurement.
That's true. And so an expression like political science is really a hark back to the old-fashioned way of using the word science as simply pure knowledge. And I would say that political science is not like the natural sciences. Yes, we can do some kind of polling and develop certain kinds of quantified knowledge. But by and large, political science is about how human actors, individuals, persons, interact with one another and trying to understand how to fashion political consensus and manage societies. That is in stark contrast to the natural sciences, where the natural sciences, in their descriptions of the world, practically speaking, from the get-go, rule out personality as a means of explaining the universe. We attempt to explain the universe through universal laws that are impersonal. And so there's a very, very stark contrast between something like political science, so-called, and the natural sciences, and their methods are totally different. And to suppose that we should pursue political science through the methods that we use to understand the natural world is, in the end, just a terrible mistake. It's a ghastly mistake.
The results of this are problematic, indeed, even for those who want to pursue the pure sciences. I think of a few years ago, perhaps a decade ago now, when you had the whole debate about postmodernism and relativity of knowledge, and the great Sokal hoax in the United States, in which Alan Sokal famously wrote a pseudo-scientific article and presented it to a prestigious scientific magazine who published it as if it were...
Social science magazine,
who published it as if it were empirical science. And, of course, Sokal was merely intent on proving something, the very thing that you're arguing about coming from another way, that really we're getting involved in category confusion here.
Yeah, I think postmodernism is a fascinating part of this, and I address it in my book. I mean, one way to think about the postmodern, let's say, critique of science, I mean, what Sokal was trying to do was to put one back over the social scientists who had, so-called, who had analyzed the natural scientists and come up with the conclusion that their knowledge was no more certain or sure than the sociologists themselves. And that was the nature of that argument. You know, I actually am slightly more sympathetic to the postmodern impulse than Sokal and his colleagues are.
But the point was that Sokal was trying to define something in exactly the same way. He was saying, no, there is such a thing as empirical science that is a narrow category,
yes,
and is different from,
yes,
this broad category, yes, called social science.
Yes, exactly. But his purpose was also to debunk social science and to bring it into disrepute, and which he actually succeeded in doing to some degree. I think the postmodern impulse, which is to raise critiques of science, is to suggest that science's knowledge is not as certain as scientists claim. I think that is actually in large measure a response not so much to science as to scientism, the improper extrapolation of the methods of science to all kinds of knowledge. And so in many ways, postmodernism is an impulse on the part of those who, by and large, are involved in other forms of knowledge, other academic disciplines, to try to tear down science because of scientism's pretension to monopoly. The problem is that neither side, in many cases, draws a distinction between science, which in its own sphere, the study of the natural world, is the most powerful way that we have of gaining a particular type of knowledge. But they fail to draw a distinction between that science and scientism, which is the presumption that science is all of the knowledge there is. And because of that, postmodernism is in danger of essentially throwing out the baby, science, with the bathwater, which is the scientism.
You're on Sunday Night. Our guest is Professor Ian Hutchinson, Professor of Nuclear Science and Engineering at MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in the United States. He's the recent author of Monopolizing Knowledge. Ian Hutchinson, let's just pause for a moment, have a piece of music, think about things, and come back and get into some of the sort of implications for religion and the argument over religion. Now, you've chosen one or two pieces of music for us. Just introduce one that perhaps would be suitable for us now.
One of the pieces that I've chosen is Scheherazade by Rimsky-Korsakov. The pieces of music I chose was really for rather personal reasons, and so this is perhaps the most personal reason of all in this particular case. Scheherazade is a wonderful piece, perhaps one of the most profound paintings of a story done purely through orchestral music. And it refers to the story of the Arabian Nights, where Scheherazade is the concubine of the ruler, and under normal circumstances that means she shares his bed for one night and is then executed. But instead, Scheherazade tells him a story, and tells him a story that is so entrancing that he wants to hear the next story next night and the story after that. And eventually they fall in love and, you know, all things work out. Well, that's not the personal part. The personal part of my story is this. I offer you this piece of music because this was the piece of music that I played to my girlfriend, as she then was, on the occasion of proposing to her marriage. And we've been married for 41 years now, Fran and I. She's an Australian girl from Sydney, and I was in Canberra at the time that when we got to know each other. So this is a very this has deep personal meaning for me, and it embodies that step of love and engagement. So that's what Scheherazade is for me.
Great theme from Scheherazade, a selection of our guest, Professor Ian Hutchinson, author of Monopolizing Knowledge, a book that leaps straight into the heart of the religion-science controversy. Ian Hutchinson, we talked a little before that beautiful piece of music about science and the problems of science. Religion has also been a bit of a bomb-throwing exercise in the United States more than anywhere else, I guess, over the last 30 years, in the return of what's called creationism and the continued argument of something that many religious people thought was settled and done 100 years ago. So religion is not without scars in this area.
That's true. There are certainly branches of the Christian church that adopt a rather literalistic view of how one should approach the Old Testament, in particular Genesis. And it's my view that supposing that the earth is only 6,000 or so years old, or resisting the very strong evidence that there now is that biological diversity arose in large measure because of common descent and the selection of acquired random characteristics by natural selection, those kinds of arguments are still very much live in some people's minds, Christians and others, in America. They are not actually topics that I find terribly interesting, and for me, has never been really the main issues to do with science versus the religious faith question.
Yes, and in fact, that's not really a debate about science, is it? It's a debate about biblical interpretation. That is, what do the texts mean, and where do they come from?
Yeah.
So to get it confused with an argument about science is, in fact, introducing a straw man into a different argument.
Well, I think that there is a sense in which Christians want to regard and do regard the Bible as an authoritative book, a revelation from God, and that's natural enough. That is what the Christian church's viewpoint has been. But what we need to do is to have a sensible approach to interpreting what that actually means. And I think that to make the Bible into a scientific textbook is just a mistake. That's not what the Bible was written as, and it's not what we should treat it as.
And in fact, biblical scholarship indicates that historically, even if you go back, that this beginning of this interpretation of the Bible as a scientific textbook is a product of the Reformation and the Enlightenment, something that people like Professor Peter Harrison address in his book on Protestantism and the Rise of Natural Science. And it's this category mistake where religious people wanted to appropriate science for the purpose that it was not appropriate for.
Yes, certainly within the 20th century, there's been a desire to tie in the confidence of one's Christian faith with some kinds of, if you like, almost scientific proofs of God's actions in the world. I think that, and it's another mistake, that's not an approach that I, generally speaking, take. And by the way, coming back to the question of scientism, I think that to some degree, that tendency on the part of Christians is driven by the scientism of our age. Because after all, if science is all the real knowledge there is, and if, you know, the Bible is true and it's real knowledge, then it better be scientific.
Yes.
So there is a sense in which there's scientism on both sides of the religion and science discussion, and that scientism is a kind of polluting and confusing factor for both of the sides of the discussion.
And in fact, it's the very thing that the new atheists, if you like to describe them, the Dawkins, the Dennetts, and others have taken advantage of.
Yes, in the writings of the people that I like to call anti-theists, meaning they're sort of aggressively against God, there is, in almost all of their writings, a deep-seated but purely implicit scientism. So they're taking the view that the only explanation that could possibly count as being something that we should give weight to is the kind of position, understanding that comes from the natural sciences. And in fact, Dawkins, in his book The God Delusion, on half a dozen different occasions, makes the bold assertion that the question of whether God exists is a scientific question. Well, I think that seems very strange to me. I mean, if there were ever a question that is not a scientific question, it would seem to me that, you know, the existence of God, metaphysical question like that, that would be one that would be a strong candidate for not being a scientific question. But of course, what Dawkins is really saying is there are no interesting questions except for scientific questions in his mind.
Yes. Testable hypotheses.
And so that's the basis on which he can not argue, but simply assert that God is a scientific question. Actually, I mean, there is a sense in which, quite directly, God, whether or not God exists, is a factual question. I would agree with that. It's a factual question. But I don't think it's a question the truth of which can be established by the methods of the natural sciences.
In raising these questions, religion in some ways escapes examination, because there are difficult questions for religion to examine. One, on the science-religion front, for example, if the universe is some 13 point whatever million or billion years old, and life has only been around for a fraction of that time, and conscious life for a millifraction of that time, it seems it took an awful long while for God to take an interest in things. And if he did, natural selection is a pretty brutal way of going about it.
Well, clearly, Christians and other religious believers have, in many ways, taken serious notice of the developments of science that have shown that the Earth is old, that the universe is old, as you're suggesting. And that's not a new phenomenon. That isn't something that's happened in the last 100 years. I mean, even if you were to think about 500 years ago, 500 years ago, Christians, and pretty much everybody else for that matter, believed that the sun orbits the Earth once a day. But now, because of science, we know, of course, that the Earth is in fact revolving on its axis every day and orbits the sun every year. So there's a way in which our cosmological view of the universe has changed because of science. So clearly, science has, over the centuries, not just, you know, in the last 100 years or so, has had an influence on the way religious people view the world. Now, does the fact that the Earth is not millions of years, but billions of years old, and so is the universe, does that make it less plausible that God is involved in it? I don't think Christians would think that. I mean, I think the Christian position is that God is the creator and that it didn't take billions of years for God to get involved in the world. No, God was involved in the world from the beginning. And it's true that conscious life took billions of years to emerge, but it doesn't seem to me implausible that that is a mechanism or a scenario that the God of Christianity would put in place. So I think there is a sense in which the critics of religion might argue that, you know, it seems implausible that God would employ these methods, but I don't see wherein the implausibility lies.
The key implausibility argument, even if you accept the deep time argument, it goes to the principal argument raised even at the time that Darwin developed his theory wasn't about evolution itself. It was about the means necessarily produce a world that is essentially violent and self-destructive in the process of life. That is, the cruelty inherent in the process, particularly for sentience, for sentient beings, raises very profound questions about the nature of suffering, the nature of evil. What about innocent suffering? These are problems that science indirectly raises for religion, which are genuinely challenging questions.
Yeah, I think that's right, and certainly Darwin himself, you know, faltered and maybe even abandoned his faith in large measure because he could not resolve this problem of pain, the issues for him which surrounded the death of his daughter. You know, so certainly suffering in the world is a challenge to any theist who believes in a loving and powerful God. You know, has science raised those questions? I actually don't think so. I mean, you know, probably the oldest book that was written at the earliest stage in the Old Testament is the book of Job, which is all about suffering and how can that be just, and how can a just God justify the suffering, some often seemingly completely unredeemed suffering of humankind. So the problem of pain or the problem of evil or the problem of suffering has been with theists since the very beginning.
Over recent years, whether it's through David Attenborough or most recently people like Brian Cox, television has become the means of disseminating science to a much wider audience. And in fact, in the media, one could almost see the science model as being the default model that we spoke of earlier as being the sort of general default model in society now. There's a no-God issue. If we look at, say, Brian Cox's current feature series on ABC television, superbly produced, even to the extent that when you listen very closely to Brian Cox's scripts, he's elevating science to almost a mystical level as a replacement for religion. Even though that's not explicitly stated, the language verges on mystery. Let me give you a quote from one of Brian Cox's earlier programs in a previous series. Quote, "We must also learn to value the human race and take responsibility for our own survival, because there's nobody else out there to value us or look after us." And then a little later on, "We must use the light of human reason to banish the darkness of superstition." Now, Brian Cox is perfectly entitled to that opinion. But inserting that into a science program, and here I'm speaking about the way in which the media generally has become part, perhaps, of the problem. In inserting to that into a science program, a script editor 15 years ago would have cut that out and said, no, you're either making a category mistake or you're stepping into other areas. We don't do that anymore.
Yeah, you're right. And I certainly, the first quote you gave, you know, that there's no one else out there to value us, that seems to me a pure presumption. Actually, it's pure presumption on the basis of science, let alone religion. I mean, we don't know if there are other sentient beings out there. So it's a little bit surprising to me that Brian Cox would make that part of his script, even if he believes there is no God. So, you know, those kinds of transitions to me are quite troubling. And it comes back to what I was saying earlier. I don't think that promotes science. I think it's just being, in a certain sense, deliberately provocative. By the way, I completely agree with the first part of his statement, is that we should take responsibility for our planet, okay? And that's terribly, terribly important. But arguing for that by this kind of pseudo-scientific metaphysics seems to me to weaken the argument, not strengthen it.
What for you, Ian Hutchinson, finally, keeps you anchored to a religious position, and particularly a Christian position, as the best explanation for the big questions?
Well, I think that there is lots of evidence for the Christian message. I think there are many reasons why one should believe in God and why it's a plausible hypothesis. But I think also there is historic testimony. There are experiences of personal faith and religion. There are philosophical arguments. There are utilitarian arguments, all of which go to make up a case for God and for Christianity, which I find persuasive. I think people over the centuries have found persuasive. And while I don't think those are proofs, and I don't think that those have any kind of mathematical or, if you like, scientific demonstrations, they are nevertheless rather persuasive. And so I think of the reasons why one should take Christianity seriously as being, in many cases, for example, comparable to those reasons why you should take seriously the idea that Julius Caesar was assassinated on the steps of the Senate, you know, in 44 BC. These are historical reasons, historical evidence. There is substantial historical evidence for the Christian faith. And so when the Brian Coxes of this world refer to science as dispelling superstition, yeah, there is much superstition that needs to be dispelled by careful thought, including scientific thought. But to label all things religious as, or to imply that all things religious are mere superstition, is not a serious argument.
And at what level does it give meaning to your life?
I certainly believe Jesus is the Son of God. I think I have a personal relationship with him in prayer and through the worship that is part of the Christian experience. And I have a sense of which, in which that is able to be rationally defended on some of the basis that I have mentioned. And I think it's something which I would want to commend to anyone to consider seriously.
And your work as a nuclear scientist is in some ways a fulfillment of your life as a Christian?
Certainly. When I'm discovering new things about nature, that is not something which separates me from God. I don't have to be an atheist in order to go into the laboratory, as some people
sometimes
say.
You don't have to have a moment of cognitive dissonance.
Exactly. I don't feel that. And in fact, in that respect, I'm like the great scientists of history. Well, not as great as them, but they very often, the scientists who founded the scientific revolution, you know, did so because, not in spite of the fact that they worshipped a God who they saw as being a creator. And I, in my own much smaller way, can share in that attitude, and I do share in it.
Ian Hutchins, it's been great to have you as our guest on Sunday night. Thank you so much for giving us your time.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
Let's have another piece of music. And finally, what would you like us to hear?
I'd like to offer Pentatonics. They are a terrific a cappella singing group. I sing myself a little bit, not quite as well as they do, and in a somewhat different style. But even though my own personal interests tend to be more in the classical area of classical music, I think the artistry of Pentatonics, which has been a sensation on the American scene over the last few years, that their artistry, their coordination, and their intonation is so perfect, and they just have a sense in which music takes on a life of its own, and everything they do, all of the sounds are made by the human voice and by the human person, no instruments whatsoever. So, Pentatonics.
Ian Hutchinson, Music and Mathematics, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The contemporary American a cappella group Pentatonics with Mary Did You Know. Bit like our own idea of North, aren't they? Well, that was a selection of our guest, Dr. Ian Hutchinson, the Professor of Nuclear Science and Engineering at MIT. His book is called Monopolizing Knowledge, and if you wish to hear him in person, he'll be presenting the 2016 Graham Clark Lecture at Scots Church in Sydney this coming Thursday, the 18th at 6 p.m. And if you want to download a copy of that interview with Ian Hutchinson or any of the material heard here on Sunday night, just go to our website, abc.net.au/Sundaynights. This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.